It's a joy to be here again this morning, and I want to just kind of pick up and stay with a theme. And you remember my theme last night was had to do with how on the university campus we all teach morality. And it's just a question of which one we teach, but much of our time was spent talking about how we do that. And it's extremely important to understand what is going on there, because under the guise of not teaching morality, a morality is taught. And because you're not teaching one, you don't really have to defend it. Right? And, of course, defending, in the sense of justifying rationally, is the business of the university, isn't it? Well, there's some hesitation here, right? And actually that hesitation is warranted, because what has happened is, in the university and the professorate generally, we have developed a professional class that didn't exist 100 years ago. It was emerging, but there was no professional class of university professors. And as a class develops, what always happens is that class looks after its own interests. And a primary interest of the professorate has been to define itself in opposition to the church. In 1840, two-thirds of the university presidents of state colleges and universities were clergymen. Did you know that? 1840. And I want to recommend this book to you. I brought it along this morning. And I really encourage anyone who's interested in our situation to take this book and read it twice at least. This is by George Marston. It's called The Soul of the American University. Now, I don't hold stock in the press or in George, but this is a wonderful book for understanding what is up. And I venture you will be astonished at what you read here, because you see the common assumptions of the American University as it emerged in the late 1800s especially, were precisely the opposite of what we have now. Precisely the opposite. And those have been turned around by the sociological process that goes into the professorate defining itself as a distinct class against the church. And very often, I don't know how much of the story you know, but it was a very explicit battle. And, for example, in England, it came to a head over the attempt to enforce the taking of an oath to the 39 articles of the Catholic, of the Anglican Church. Not much difference at that point. And there were many people that were turned out of their positions because of this. They had to take an oath to the 39 articles of the Anglican Church, if they were to be permitted to teach. And, of course, that battle was lost. And that's an important part of an important story. And see, what I really said to you last night when I was talking about knowledge is that knowledge is too important to be left to the university. And I want to say that again, because now this is a very serious point. Knowledge is too important to be left to the university. And in particular, you must not allow the university to define knowledge, because they will define it in their own interest. They will define it in such a way as to enhance their power. And that definition will be inadequate intellectually, and it will be designed to fortify their position. Now, currently, they have achieved the position of the authoritative institution in our culture. That's the position they're in. Now, if you want to question that, well, then who are you? Because they are in charge of knowledge. And I say they, I should say us. But if you don't agree with them, then they will wonder whether you really are of us. Howard Van Cleve gave me an article he'd taken out of the Chronicle of Higher Education, who does suffer from passing bouts of rare honesty upon occasion. And I want to just read a few words to you from that. The status of religion on campuses has undergone a significant change. It is not those of heterodox persuasion who feel themselves under fire on campuses, if they ever were. It is religious believers, both faculty members and students, who face an inquisition with the de facto assumption of guilt, because their values often conflict with the political priorities of the campus administration and governing bodies. And, of course, that priority is, above all, to assert the position of authority. And that means defining what counts as knowledge, as well as indicating which bits of information are knowledge and which are not. And they find themselves accused of intolerance and discrimination, that is, Christian believers. For the past 15 years, our colleges and universities have scapegoated traditional religious believers, especially Christians and Jews, and not religious believers of other persuasions. And the reason for that is because these authorities do not take those other positions as serious claimants to knowledge. Whereas there is still the hangnail, if you wish, the sociological hangnail, that these Christians and Jews actually claimed things to happen. They made claims. But see, they patronize the other religions and call it diversity. If they did not patronize them, they would have to do the same thing with them that they do with Christians. And it's remarkable the extent to which this has internalized itself in Christians. A dean of the theology division, one of the Canadian universities recently, was asked why he didn't open classes with prayer. Now, here's what he said. He said, because that would compromise my scholarly objectivity. Now, see, he hadn't made any empirical studies to see whether or not people who opened their class with prayer were actually suffering in the dimension of scholarly objectivity. See, he had never looked into that. See, that was an a priori assumption, and he easily made it. And it never occurred to ask himself the question, might I not be sacrificing my scholarly objectivity by not opening in prayer? See, it never occurred to him. See, that's the thing I think I need to emphasize so strongly with you. It is what does not occur to people. See, the mark of a difference, a mark of a culture is you think it doesn't need justification. Your culture is obvious. Now, this man had been trained in a culture which takes it as obvious, number one, that God is irrelevant to knowledge, and number two, that people who believe in God do so because they lack scholarly objectivity. Do you understand what I'm saying? I see it's extremely important to understand how this happens. And that's a part of the idea that a person who doubts is inherently smarter than one who believes. Now, never mind that you can be as dumb as a cabbage and still say why. Right. Right, because these are not empirical issues. No one examines Christians as vis-a-vis non-Christians to see if, for example, Christians can't balance their checkbook as well as a non-Christian. And now the fault does not lie entirely on the side of the now secularized mind, because the Christian mind gave it away. And a large part of that was in an ill-advised effort to defend itself. It said, we will not fight the battle on that ground. We give that to you. We give you objectivity. We give you truth. We give you knowledge. Ours is, in a special tone, faith. And now then, we have isolated ourselves to protect what we call faith. And now we farm faith out to student life. I said that last night, but I want to say it again because it's so relevant to our work as Christians. You farm faith out to student life, and you isolate it from knowledge. So now then, the assumption is that God is irrelevant to the fields of knowledge. That belief in God is irrelevant to the fields of knowledge. Now, this is not my theme, but if it were, we could go at great lengths talking about what that does to the fields of knowledge, to account for the incredible scene of incoherence and disconnection. It is trite now to say, but it needs to be said, that it's all varsity and no unity, because there is no way to achieve unity. And the blind pursuit of materialism and physicalism is an attempt to bring unity into knowledge. But of course it has not succeeded. It isn't close. There's no likelihood it will succeed. And whenever you can reduce business management to chemistry, let me know. Right, now that is the hope. We talk about integrating faith with knowledge, which is an interesting phrase, isn't it? Sometimes we say faith with learning. I'm waiting to see economics integrated with biology. Why don't we do that first? See, that's where the serious work lies. And the truth is, we operate in a field of incredible chaos and treat it as if it were somehow the same thing. And that's where our smorgasbord approach to education comes from. It's often treated as if, well, you ought to give the kiddies a choice. But the only reason you give the kiddies a choice is because the grown-ups don't see any unity. So why not? Need a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you know. And you come out and you're a well-rounded, educated person. Well, who would know whether you are or not? What counts as an educated person? We know at USC it's someone with a USC degree. So now, these matters about knowledge are extremely important. I just returned to them. And I think I will add on one I mentioned last night, that we not only teach morality, we teach theology. And I want to give you just a few words of Noah Porter, who was the president of Yale during the years that this thing broke in the direction I'm now describing. And you can find this on pages 126 and 127 of Marsden's book, The Soul of the American University. Noah Porter wrote, "Religious influences and religious teaching should be employed in colleges in order to exclude and counteract the atheistic tendencies of much of modern science, literature, and culture." Now, see, that sounds like someone on the right wing of evangelical or political thought would say today. But what he meant was, you had to develop this as a part of knowledge, not as a political counter-thrust to a political thrust of liberalism. He said, "Every educated man," this is quoting Porter again, "every educated man nowadays must either accept or reject the ill-disguised materialism of Huxley, the cerebralism of Bain and the thin and vacillating metaphysics of Mill, the evolutionism of Herbert Spencer with its demonstrated impossibility of a positive theism, and the serene fatalism of the devotees of nature or of the absolute. Now, we can just change the names, and today you'll see that what is taught as knowledge in one way or another is precisely what he's describing. Noah Porter pointed out that faced with these teachings, the question is not whether the college shall or shall not teach theology, but what theology it shall teach. Theology according to Comte and Spencer, these were unbelievers, or according to Bacon, who was a believer, and Christ. Theology according to Moses and Paul, or according to Buckle and Draper. So now when you pick up Stephen Hawking or Stephen Jay Gould today, you find them explicitly addressing theological questions and giving an answer to them on their supposed expertise in their field. Now, that's what we face, is a constant. Now, how are people today to do otherwise? Because they go to graduate school, and they professionalize in their field, and they get accepted, and they are told, you are prepared to present the knowledge in their field, and that is presented as an adequate course content, to simplify it. Because that is the issue, isn't it? Adequacy of course content. We all face that issue. If you're going to teach chemistry, you want to be adequate. Well, where do you get adequate? You go to a university that gives PhDs in chemistry. And when you come out, you are adequate. Or you wouldn't have come out. Right? Now, that knowledge is presented without any connection to the issues that, for example, Stephen Jay Gould and Stephen Hawking and Dawkins and all the others who occupy the contemporary press and public television. See, they all present this as if somehow this is adequate knowledge without any reference to God. See, now that is the question. I mean, I'm going to state it bluntly so we can come to deal with it. Is a presentation of mathematics that says nothing about God adequate to the field? Now, if it is, God is out of here. Is a presentation of physics, chemistry, biology, economics, public administration, music theory and history, is that adequate without a knowledge of how the subject matter relates to God? That's the question. Another way of putting it, and I often use this when I'm talking to Christian faculty in Christian schools, in what exact respect is a Christian teacher better than a non-Christian teacher? In particular, are they just nicer? Or do they actually know something? And I'm sorry, I can't really bring myself to try to drag you deeper into the issues of knowledge. I'm hoping that what I'm saying you can get a hold of, and then you can work on it further if you wish. Do Christians actually know something relevant to chemistry that the person who does not know God doesn't know? So now the Christian schools are constantly faced with that issue because they have to get faculty. And in getting their faculty, they have to decide whether or not they're going to get the best people out of the graduate schools or people who are not so good but profess Christian faith. And that is a constant drag on the Christian schools, and most of them, in one way or another, over time, will relent. And if we don't solve the issue that I'm discussing here today, you're going to see another crop of Christian schools go the way of Harvard and Yale, because they will not eventually be able to defend the position that they have something vital to teach unless the people in these fields rise up and deal with the issue I'm trying to address, we have to address it. And in campus ministry, we face the same issue. Do Christians know something, or are they just nicer? Okay. Now back to the notes, and if you turn into the section where it says how moral knowledge disappeared from the university campus. And I will start with a text. I believe the Bible is a book that provides knowledge. Now, it does it in a peculiar way, and I don't have time to discuss the issues of how to develop a biblical epistemology, but that is one of the great issues that faces us. And I just want to read these words from Isaiah, the 5th chapter and the 20th verse. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Now, any good sociologist of knowledge who has read his Marx and Hegel and Derrida can tell you that the difference between good and evil and bitter and sweet is a social construction. That the difference between light and dark is a social construction. And consequently, anyone who talks about good and evil as if this were a reality in its own right, regardless of how you found that in creation or human nature, as if they were objective realities, is benighted and probably a closet Nazi. And they will assure you of that. And we see this now in our popular culture. You see, this has percolated in the cultural system for 300 years. And we saw one art after another going the way of calling good evil and evil good. And after the Second World War, it reached the popular arts. For example, those of you, there are a few here old enough, I think, to remember Bing Crosby. Der Bingle, the Germans called him, because they loved to listen to his broadcasts in the Second World War. Those of you who remember him, can you remember any note of social criticism in Bing's singing? None. There wasn't any. And if you remember the other people of that generation or after, I mean, how about Perry Como? Right? You remember Perry criticizing society? Or Dean Martin? But after the Second World War and the struggles of the 50s, people talk about the 60s, the breakdown was really in the 50s. It was in the 50s when the nation lost its moral vision. It did not know what to do, having come to the top of the world. It's like in dog races, they have these electric rabbits. And one night down in Florida, the rabbit broke down and the dogs caught it. And they didn't know what to do. They had never caught the rabbit before. And so they were just jumping around and nipping at one another and carrying on. I mean, what do you do when you catch the rabbit? That was America's problem in the 50s. And apart from some really wonderful things that were done, they lost their vision. And it was the revulsion at that, which became known as the establishment. You remember the establishment? There used to be one. Actually, there's one now, but it's a different one. But what was called the establishment in the 50s was a social and economic order that had lost its moral point. And the greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw calls it, went and did a glorious thing and came home and didn't know what to do. And that's where the moral vision of America broke down. And then the 60s step into that, and the voices now become the voices of the Beatles and Bob Dylan. See, good old Elvis, the king, he never criticized society. He's just talking about, don't step on my blue suede shoes. Yeah. It was Dylan and the Beatles that began to critique society and to turn what was good into evil and evil into good. Now, of course, there was a point of their criticism. If there had been no point, they wouldn't have gotten a hearing. So please understand that. The point, however, was much deeper than they even dreamed. And they couldn't come to deal with the issue, and so they began to reverse this. And they are a part of the changes in culture that result in the disappearance of moral knowledge. Now, it has disappeared. If you look at the next, this one here, I just give a couple of anecdotes here. Now, when I say knowledge, moral knowledge has disappeared, I say it's not available to anyone who comes and wants to know. I used the multiplication tables last night. Knowledge of the multiplication tables has not disappeared. It's available. Moral knowledge has disappeared. Robert Coles, in one of the better moments of the Chronicle of Higher Education, you know, it uses the back page, and often very valuable things appear there. And Robert Coles tells a story about how one of his young female students came to him one day and said, I'm leaving Harvard. She was from Ohio. And said, I'm going home. And the reason I'm going home is because I've been in two of your classes with a student, and we talk about good and evil, and this boy gets A's, but I have to work part-time, and I clean his rooms. And he constantly propositions me for sex when I clean his room. Now, what is the point, she said, of all this talk about good and evil if it doesn't make any difference in your behavior? Now, why didn't it make any good difference in the behavior? Very simply, Coles didn't teach it. Not once did Coles ever say in class, you should not proposition a woman who is cleaning your room. There was no question on a test that said true or false. It is wrong to proposition a woman who is cleaning your room. You know that's true, don't you? You know that he could not have put that question on the test. Right? And why not? Because that is not a part of knowledge. If he'd put that question on the test and someone said, that's false, and he had said, no, no, that's true, then that student could have taken his test to the dean. And the dean would have said, called Mr. Coles in, and we would have said to him, now, Mr. Coles, of course we know you're right, but we must not impose our opinions on our students. Okay. That's exactly what he would have said. And if the dean hadn't said that, the man could have gone to law. And eventually a judge would have said that. Now, see, the reason I'm taking you through all of this, and I'm hoping you understand, and you may disagree, and that's fine. If so, I hope you'll tell me. I'm taking you through, I want you to see how deeply this is embedded in our culture. See, it's now in the institutions of law. It's now in the institutions of law. And that's what we get from the bench. And eventually it comes out of a change in the understanding of law that is due largely to Oliver Wendell Holmes and his idea that law should reflect social process and the changes of opinions and so on. Of course, you never get that. What you get are the opinions of an elite about the changes of opinion that have occurred. And that institutionalizes the whole attitude towards moral knowledge. Diane Sawyer's story, I mention her because she, 2 years ago, she had a, I forget which one of her programs, one of these magazine things, and it was interviewing young women, one set of which had become pregnant in high school, of course out of wedlock, and another set of which were virgins by their own choice. And Diane, in her wondrous manner, was questioning these people. And the people who had become pregnant out of wedlock said, "Don't do it, girls." And the reasons they gave were, "Well, you know, now I have to take my baby to high school with me." And the ones who did do it, the virgins, said, "Well, it was our personal choice." Now, here's what's interesting. Neither group said it is wrong. Neither group said it is right. See, that is not a part of the vocabulary. If they had said that, I will guarantee you Diane Sawyer would not have put them on. And that's what we call a free press. Takes an outsider to see this sort of thing. Solzhenitsyn's address at Harvard, which got him in so much trouble, was precisely an illustration of an outsider who could see that what we call a free press is a highly repressive system orchestrated by the academy. Now, of course, moral reality has not disappeared. People still ruin themselves morally. They still become hateful people to themselves and others. They still wind up without what we call last night a good heart. And they may wind up at the top of a business organization or government organization with a golden parachute that reaches from here to Detroit. But they're still morally rotten. They're still ruined, and they know it, and everyone else knows it. But in a context where moral knowledge has disappeared, they can brave it out. You see, the thug on the street or in the boardroom used to know that there was someone somewhere who knew that they were wrong. Now what they know is there is no one anywhere who knows that they're wrong. And so it totally changes the configuration for them. Sometime back, a man by the name of Kilpatrick wrote a book called Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong. You may have seen that book. It's a fascinating book. The short answer is, Johnny can't tell right from wrong because no one taught him. Now you say, but there are many character development programs in schools. I know about those programs. I'm very familiar with them. And I admire the people who undertake to do them. But see, the one thing they do not do is they do not take up this issue of knowledge and reality. They believe that if you train kiddies at a certain age to be respectful and honest and so on, then they will continue to be that way. And now let me say to you, just simply, again, I just apologize because I say so much here that needs to be developed at such length. And I just can't, I'm now trying to write a book on the disappearance of morality, of moral knowledge from Western culture. And I'm inclined to talk about it. Only slightly less than I am inclined to talk about my granddaughter. But you'll understand, I trust. I'm doing my best to hold myself in here. But this is a very a deep issue, very deep problem. And the fact of the matter is, you can train people to do things, but if you do not lay a foundation in knowledge, they will not stay with it. And that is actually a psychological fact. What people believe is based in knowledge and reality, in their own self-identity, and in the facts of the world about them, they will adhere to. So you have to create beliefs, and the way you create beliefs that are strong is to lay a foundation in knowledge for those beliefs. And if you don't have that foundation, you can't create the beliefs. And so the kiddies are trained, and bless their precious hearts. My heart aches for them. Then by the time they walk into my classes, they've already dropped all that, because they have been informed that is not smart. They have been informed that all of that is an imposition of your elders, and they probably learned it in middle school, because that's the point at which they begin to talk seriously about who knows and who doesn't, and in particular, it turns out that parents don't. Right. And teachers, they're just pushing a line. Who really knows? The kid down the street. And where do you get it? MTV. See, that's the education process. And by the time they get to my, they've already dropped it all. And there's no one there to say to them, hey, you know, when we talk about morality, we're talking about something that has to do with how things really are. And so they can't sustain the things that they learned or were trained in character formation or character counts classes in their schools. Well, let's look at the stages in the disappearance. These are somewhat chronologically arranged. It's important for us to understand this, and first of all, the ascendancy of empiricism. This is the third. Here we go, the one on the screen. Now, empiricism is the view, roughly, that the only things you know are what you have sense perceptions of. And this is not a clear view, because no one can draw a boundary on what you have sense perception of. And for example, do I see people sitting out here in front of me, or do I see colors and shapes and so on? You know that story. And I hope you do. Because, I mean, empiricism presents itself as a clear response first to authoritarianism and then to rationalism. But in fact, it is not a clear position at all. But that's the basic idea. So one of my students had written on the back of her pants, if it feels good, do it. Right? You've probably seen that. And I didn't say to her, how about if it feels like kicking? I often do that, and I'm tempted in various ways. That, like I'm tempted to say to some of my students, I see your navel. It has a ring in it. But obviously this is not a topic of conversation. Should be, because it's incredible how... See, feel good. See, David Hume is the ultimate source of the rabid form of empiricism that we have today. And it is the idea, as he put it, that you can't even have an idea of something of which you have had no impression, and he meant a sense impression. So empiricism, as a theory of knowledge, lies really at the foundation of the problem. And gradually, it has eaten away. When Hume first published his philosophy, everyone regarded it, and I say everyone, and there's almost no exception in his contemporaries, regarded it as a reductio ad absurdum of empiricism. It took a century and a half or so for the culture to accept it, and that's the way philosophical ideas work. And now it's almost assumed to be from on high, that if you don't feel it, if you don't have sense perception of it, you couldn't possibly know it, and it's not real. Now today, empiricism is less likely to be mentioned than science or naturalism. It basically comes out to the same place, and empiricism actually, it's hard to find anyone in philosophy who actually believes anything that Hume said. But the spirit of his philosophy comes down. And a few things, especially what he said about the self, are still accepted. But what you have here is a sociological process that is actually the continuation of man's attempt to master his world. And man's attempt to master his world is primarily directed through his body to what is sense perceptible. And that's the Babel project. And that project continues to today. To have a name and a place without God. To be God. To take the place of God. And so then, for example, when you have people like Dawkins and others that I mentioned, they will wind up ascribing to the physical universe the attributes traditionally assigned to God. And they will do that on the basis of some sort of calculation with a more or less direct connection with sense perception. So empiricism is very important. Now, let me say, empiricism is not a discovery. No one discovered this. They decided it. And in watching the development of modern thought, you have to distinguish those. And you say, how do you know they didn't discover it? Well, very simply, if empiricism is true, then one of the things you can't have any knowledge about is knowledge. Because knowledge isn't sense perceptible. Right. Now, this theme is developed at great length by many critics who wrote a dissenting opinion. And perhaps I would mention, first of all, one of my favorite 20th century philosophers, Husserl, Edmund Husserl, in a book called Crisis of European Humanity. But some of you will also know Polanyi and A.N. Whitehead and others. They all wrote criticisms of this. But see, what you're up against here is not a rational position. It is a sociological and historical thrust based upon the human need to dominate its world. And I mentioned here Pitcomb Sorokin, The Crisis of Our Age. If you're not familiar with that book, I really encourage you to try to become familiar. It's a very simple reading. You don't have to read much of it, but it's extremely important to understand it. Sorokin was a sociologist, and he told the story sociologically of how the dominance of what is felt moved gradually into place as the authoritative epistemology. Right. Now, that's why feeling is so dominant in our culture today, see. You probably know a song, Feeling. Whoa, 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 feeling. Huh? You know that song? Huh? You get it on elevators and restaurants and bus trips and things of that sort. Feeling. Whoa, 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 feeling. I don't sing at this price, so I'll just refer you to the recording. Well, see, that's where people live now. And that's how moral issues are approached on the campus by and large. And it is largely a result of this triumph of empiricism. Well, second stage. And this is historically, I mean, you can really do a lot for those of you who especially are in these fields. And I really encourage you to think about these things and write on them. But secondly is the ascendancy of the will. And this is primarily associated with what is called Romanticism. Figures such as Schiller and Hegel and all of these others that fit into that. The primacy of will. And revolutionary Romanticism, which is the leading popular ideology of the Western world, and to the everlasting pain of the Eastern world, it is often imposed upon it, for example, in the killing fields of Cambodia. This idea is that will is ultimate, that freedom is ultimate. If you go out on a third grade playground and ask the little kiddies, should people be permitted to do what they want? What will they say? Absolutely. Would it be wrong to prevent people from doing what they want? Well, if you have a very thoughtful third grader, they might well, you know, this guy just wanted to bash my head with the baseball bat. But usually they don't think that far ahead. And they say, well, of course it's wrong. See, the idea, everyone ought to be able to do what they want. Isn't this a democracy? That's a joke. Okay, I'm sorry. But that's what people will say. And in a democracy, aren't you supposed to be able to do what you want? Sure. And in the process of political activities, you'll hear that cited often. That's one of the values that has survived. I mean, in our culture, the only two unquestioned values, they're not consistent, are pleasure, which is sometimes mistakenly called happiness, and freedom. Those two things. And then knowledge, of course, would restrict the will. Truth would restrict the will. So I'm hoping that one of the things that will come out of our discussions is that you will suspect at least that there's a real problem between will and truth. There's a real problem. It's not an accident that there is a comedy, so-called comedy, called Will and Grace. You ask yourself what that's about. And if you know, sometimes I have to bring myself to see these things because I have to comment on them. I need to comment on them. So once on an airplane from Seattle to Los Angeles, I watched an episode of Will and Grace. Well, I mean, I can't begin to describe to you what's there. But the idea is basically grace makes it possible for you to do what you want. I won't go into the theological connections here, but I hope you'll think about them. And I have students, I remember explaining to students at the opening of one class what truth was. And in particular, I pointed out, as I did last night, that no one has ever yet changed a proposition from true to false by believing it. And that 1 million Frenchmen can still be wrong. And I remember a very bright young man coming and said, that was very convincing. He said, of course, I can't believe it because I'm a liberal. Now, see, the connection was that if you're a liberal, you believe that people should be able to do what they want, and that is inconsistent with the idea that truth is unyielding. And he was utterly sincere. And I know many others in the class think the same thing. Because they are trained to believe that truth gives way to will, because will is ultimate. So this is a big deal. And of course, the one reason why they believe that is there's no teaching to the contrary. Often, ironically, those of you who know something about what we muck around in philosophy, this is often held simultaneously with rigid determinism, which is the view that no one ever does anything that they could avoid. Well, third here now, the loss of the human self and knowledge of the self. The self as a construct or philosophical silipati. That is to say, the self is whatever your society constructs it as. And so one of the recent evolutions in this is the deconstructionist idea that language constructs the self. That language writes through the writer. The writer doesn't write through language. And the disappearance of the human self now is a cornerstone in this whole idea of the disappearance of moral knowledge. And that is tied back to number one, empiricism, and it is also tied to number two, because if you had an identity, that would mean there's certain things you couldn't do. So self-identity is a construct. It is dropped. because identity restricts freedom. Right? So that is why today we have such issues over gender, sexuality, and so on. It's all predicated on the idea that these are constructs, and that in itself, no one has an identity other than one that is constructed by them. And for all you can tell from reading this literature, there's no difference between a squirrel and a Brussels sprout. It's just all a construct. And so, for example, then rights. See, rights stand in this continuity here, and rights all refer to public guarantees of freedom. And now they become the whole moral life. And so in discussions, often people think of their moral life entirely in terms of the rights that they enjoy and whether or not other people are respecting them. Right? And often they may extend those to other people. And they'll say things like, well, my rights shouldn't conflict with yours and yours shouldn't conflict with mine. But, of course, to work that out is, frankly speaking, impossible if your view of the moral life is restricted to rights. So I recommend things like T-shirts that say, stand up for your responsibilities. But I don't see any of those. There's not a large market for those. I'm trying to get some Christian entrepreneur to put out a T-shirt that says on the front, practice safe sin. Tell me, would that be politically incorrect? On the back it would say no sin. But by the time they got back there, they probably wouldn't be looking back. They'd... Now, screen here. By contrast, the entire point of morality has always been and still is to restrict desire and will. That's the only point, practically speaking, of morality. It is to give us reason to not do what we want to do and to do what we do not want to do. And no person or society will succeed as a rule if they take pleasure and freedom as their ultimate goals. If you put pleasure and freedom within an appropriate context, then they have a place. Right? And so the Christian teaching is not like the Stoic or the Vedic, the elimination of desire. Desire is okay. It's good. God made it. It cannot be your master. It's a good servant. And if you put it in place, it works wonderfully well. And desire is fine. And freedom is fine. But it cannot be an objective, ultimate objective. See, we have those wonderful lines. Chris Christopherson sang them. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Freedom ain't worth nothing, but it's free. So me and Bobby McGee. Right? And actually that poem, or that song, who wrote it? Come on, some of you know. Janis Joplin wrote it, that's right. That song, I mean, look what it meant to her. And we have a whole litany of such people. Chris Christopherson has a background and better sense that protected him from the song, if you know the details of his life. So this is the whole point of a morality. It is to give us reason to not do what we want. And no one can manage a successful life, even in crude terms, unless they are prepared to do the things they don't want to do when they need to be done. And unless they're prepared to not do the things they want to do when not doing them needs to be done. I mean, that's the secret. And if you do not have a strong, reasonable morality enforced by a tradition of strength, you will not have a morality. We're still piggybacking sociologically on our past in Western culture. But there's, I mean, show me a person who has built their life around the ethics of John Rawls, the ethics of John Stuart Mill. Show me a person. They don't exist. A morality isn't that kind of thing. A morality has to come out of a tradition. And that tradition has to have a foundation in reality. Well, just a very quick trip on the next screen. The declension of academic moral theory. This is mainly what the book is about. So we're going to go here at the speed of light. If you look at the ethics that was actually taught, and again, the book by George Marsden is a wonderful source on this. If you look at the ethics that was actually taught in the university or academic scene in the 1880s and really all the way into the 1900s, you will see that it was really an intellectually refined Judeo-Christian moral theory. And there's a wonderful consistency to it, amazing application, and it was taught as a body of knowledge. And I give you writers here, these are some of the most original people, Henry Sidgwick, F.H. Bradley, T.H. Green. And Green is an especially important one to read, but of course for all of these guys write like philosophers, and they're very hard to read. But if you, like McKinsey has a manual of ethics, a man named McKinsey, and if you read that, it's much easier to get into because it's written for university students. You read Bradley or Green, they'll set your hair on fire. They're so difficult. But they are the ones who hammer this out. And John Dewey, the ex-Sunday school teacher, is one of the teachers here. And if you read what he taught as ethics, you'll see that it is simply an intellectually refined Judeo-Christian moral theory. Now, what happens, actually, between this stage and the next stage is the rise of psychology as a discipline. And the effect of the rise of psychology as a discipline is to make the human self disappear from the arena of knowledge. Isn't that strange? But that was the effect. And that was enforced by the need of psychology to be empirical. And the result of that was the loss of the self, because the self is actually not an empirical object. A lot to say there, isn't it? So then you have 20th century intuitionism, which cuts ethical theory loose from the human self and makes it merely a matter of intuiting rightness, goodness, or whatever. And the intuition, of course, is not empirical, because goodness, rightness, and so on aren't empirical, and some thinkers were able to sustain that for a while, but then they were unable to do it for long, and in fact I call it implicit nihilism here, that because that's what it was. And then explicit nihilism in the form of positivism or emotivism, and I don't know how well you know those views or if any of you have read them, but the basic idea is that when we say something is right or wrong, We're not saying anything. It's not true. It's not false. It's you don't respond, oh, that's true or that's false, anymore than if you're at your football game and someone says hooray for the Longhorns and you turn around and say, that's false. Well, you'd say that, because what they're saying is not a statement. Right? That's what we do in sports. We're going to win. We're behind 90-3, and it's the last 10 seconds of the game, but people are still hollering, we're going to win. So this became known as the boo hooray theory of morals, because right was like saying hooray, and wrong was like saying boo. And then I don't really fill all this out, but you have a progression here, an attempt to reconstruct morality as a dimension of language, which completely failed, and then the resurgence of rights talk and professional ethics to meet the needs of the 60s and afterwards. because people were unwilling to say things like, my conviction that the Vietnam War or racism is wrong is merely an expression of my feeling, has no truth value. And so there was a revival that based around that and resulted in the social constructionism of people like McIntyre and Rawls. So where we stand today, and on these theories, I just ran a graduate seminar on these, testing this claim that turns out to be true, that there none of these theorists, these contemporary theorists, even though they're very highly regarded, like Rawls and McIntyre, on none of them is moral knowledge possible. And that's not a secret. This is what they say. So where do we stand today? No accepted knowledge of concrete moral distinctions, only feelings. We have theories about what it is justifiable to do in this or that situation. And that's where the young man in Robert Cole's class made A's by discussing theories. Okay. So you can make an A in moral philosophy by discussing theories. And finally, this is almost entirely about social issues, never about personal morality. So we saw that in our recent round with Mr. Clinton. Right. I mean, these personal morality, and it's his business. Right? Because why is it his business? Because there's no knowledge here. There's no truth or falsity. So that's where we stand now, and we want to go back to Jesus' teaching next time. Thank you very much.